My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Advise
her
to go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hi, everyone. If you're in the highball, we are about to do a podcast recording of the King Cast. So just letting you know, we suggest that you stay and pay attention, but lower your voices and be respectful. Thank you so much. If you want to yell, there's a beautiful breezeway outside. Thank you.
Hello. Hey, what's up, everybody? Hi. I like that everybody, like, once they said, oh, there's going to be some Stephen King nerding that's going on, like, a third of the people are like, I got to get the fuck out of here. They are going to be the ones missing out. Thank you guys for coming to this live recording of the King Cast. We are a Stephen King podcast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. If you've never listened to the show, well, you're about to get a little taste of some Stephen King nerdiness. I hope you're ready for it. We have two very exciting guests that are joining me up on this stage, two promising up-and-coming genre filmmakers. I'm going to bring them up now. We have the director of Bone Lake, Mercedes Bryce Morgan. And the director of Shelby Oaks, Mr. Chris Stuckman.
Need to scooch in there.
Yeah. Welcome. Both of you guys are newbies to the show, so sometimes when we do these live things, we bring in seasoned vets, but no, not this time.
Well, I'm a newbie, physically being a newbie, but I listen all the time, so okay. This is a real honor for me, man.
Tell me more. What's your favorite episode?
I don't know.
No, please don't.
I love your show, though. I mean, I'm obviously a gigantic King fan, so yeah. It's so cool to be here.
Well, I usually ask the first-time guests on the show what their Stephen King origin story is, and that means the first time that Stephen King popped up on your radar as a presence in pop culture. It could be a book cover, it could be a movie, it could be one of the generation-scarring TV series that have come out. You know, yeah. It could be literally anything, and we've gotten wild answers. So do you guys have a thought on
yes.
what your first...
I mean, I feel like the cliche answer is The Shining, because yeah. it's so classic for everyone, but I feel like if I were to answer more so the one that made the biggest impact on me first, I would have to say Carrie, because the scene of her getting her period in the worst imaginable way possible is so right. scarring to watch mm-hmm. as a woman, so that stuck with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as a kid, I would see Stephen King covers or Stephen King movies like on VHS or whatever, and I would be so... amazed by the cover art and so enticed by it, but I wasn't allowed to read or watch any of them. Goosebumps books were like my entryway into horror as a kid in third grade. And with Stephen King, I would be afraid to even touch the book because my parents were so religious. They were like, if you touch one of these things, you will bring a demon home with you. And it was like a very real fear. It's funny now, but it was like an actual thing. They were so serious about like, don't look at The Exorcist. I remember when I saw The Burbs. There's a scene in The Burbs where he's just channel surfing and The Exorcist pops up for a second. And I was like, ah, like you can't show me that. I'm not allowed to look at that. But for King, it was The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon was the first book of his I ever read.
Oh, interesting.
And I think it was because when I finally left the religion that I was raised in, I was like, there's this whole new world of amazing literature and horror that I can discover and, you know, take in. And I wanted to try something that was shorter first. And I wasn't quite sure if I was ready for maybe some of his more intense works.
Right. Yeah, I get asked a lot, like, what's a good entry point? Because, you know, I'm a movie kid. I grew up a movie kid. And so that was my entry point into King. And in around sixth grade, I picked up Cujo for the first time. Because I'd seen the movie, so I'm like, this is like a step above. I don't know, you guys are maybe younger than I am, but we had these like movie tie-in, like books on tape or records yeah. where you would like, and then when Indiana Jones's whip cracks, turn the page.
Yeah,
and
no, you're I had one of those for stuff. I think it was Batman Forever or something. It was like a movie tie-in Batman Forever audio cassette.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so I viewed reading Cujo in sixth grade again as like, oh, this is just a step up from that. I've already seen the movie, so it just doesn't have any pictures, and then I'm not getting a notification to turn the page by, you know, a Wookiee growling or whatever. and of course, you know, in sixth grade, all the stuff in Cujo, a third of it's just family melodrama about an adultery happening, right?
Right.
And, you know, a dude, like, jizzing on some bed sheets and stuff. And I'm like, what? Like, I don't know. Like,
classic,
like, this wasn't in the movie.
There. Yeah.
So they must have cut that out of the Dee Wallace movie, I think. But yeah, no, it's really interesting how King can touch everybody, even if they've never once picked up one of his books. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we've had people on the show multiple times that have never read. I haven't talked to you, Mercedes. Have you actually read the Stephen King?
No.
That's fine. I mean, having, you know... King has had such a really interesting relationship with alt media, right? So, and I don't mean alternate media like Alex Jones shit, but like he's had an interesting relationship with having his stuff. He's kept alive by the movies. You see it, you know, happen almost in cycles, like with the latest It movie coming out that like propelled his name to a whole new generation. Like I talked to somebody, she goes by the name Gory Corey. She's a Fangoria regular. She was in high school. She was a high school reporter. And she came on the show and was talking about how her generation knows King from the It movie and Stranger Things, even though he has fuck all to do with Stranger Things. But there's so many references to that. He's kept alive generationally, which is more than, you know, Dean Koontz ain't got that, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's kind of crazy to have something where it's not just parents to kids, but then it's their kids.
Right.
It's extremely rare to see ever.
Right.
Yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit. Usually the format of the show is we pick one title and have the guest and me and my co-host Anthony Bresnikan, we'll go through and talk about the title. But we have multiple people on the show this time. And I asked you guys to pick a title you wanted to talk about, so we can go down the line. What is the title that you wanted to talk about here?
So I wanted to talk about The Long Walk.
All right.
Because I saw it in theaters earlier this week.
Right.
And I have so many thoughts, and I just want to discuss it with everybody that I talk to. But especially because it kind of felt like this 90s drama, a really good 90s drama meets a horror film,
mm-hmm.
and it's so exciting to see that.
Right.
And
I loved it. It
yeah,
was so good.
It's amazing.
Yeah, David Johnson is incredible in that film.
Yes.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Like, genuinely Oscar-worthy. Yeah. I was so... And so is Cooper Hoffman. Both of them play off each other so well. But I was really impressed with how Francis Lawrence showed it. Like, the stuff that goes down. Like, he did not cut away. And then in the scenes where he had to do, where he did, there was the level of restraint that he used. I thought it was just the perfect balance.
Yeah.
We'll see this one.
Yeah.
Sorry, kid from Jojo Rabbit. but these other ones will be in the background, you know? And,
right.
It was just paced, for lack of a better term.
Exactly.
Perfectly.
Yeah, and especially for something that, it's almost a contained movie in a way, even though it's not.
Yeah.
Because this movie, it could be a play. If you think
right.
about it. It could be people just walking in place, and it exists on the tension of their conversations and what they're talking about. And to your point, too, of how it's paced, the badly directed version of this movie is people get shot in the head the same way every time.
Yeah.
But how do you take the same thing happening and show it in a different way, or divert the expectations of how this is going to go down? And it does that very well.
Definitely.
Did everybody who's listening, have you guys seen The Long Walk yet? Yeah, you guys like it? Yeah, I was really impressed. This is like a top five King book for me. This is legitimately one of my favorite books of his. And it is... It's been something that struggled to get to the screen. George Romero tried to do it in the like late 80s, and it didn't happen. That would have been a fucking wild movie. Darabont had the rights for a while. And it finally, you know, crossed the finish line. And I wasn't... When I heard Francis Lawrence got it, I'm like, that's the Hunger Games guy, right? This is going to be a little bit PG-13 or whatever. And
thing is, when I think of Francis Lawrence, I think of fucking Constantine.
Constantine,
you know what I'm saying?
Right?
Like, that's for me is like, that's my favorite Francis Lawrence movie.
Yeah.
And I really was like, okay, I hope that he can bring like that same level of fun. But right. I mean, it was bleak though. It was a sad movie.
Oh, yeah. Because I always wonder, I go, are we in the hopeful era? Are we not? And then I saw this movie and I go, maybe we're not in the hopeful era anymore as of recently again.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know if it's gonna turn audiences off really, but it, you know, to me, you know, the heart of that, what's really interesting about the way Francis brought it to life is if for anybody not you know, who doesn't know, it's kind of like in an alternate world of ours that's very close to ours but slightly different. There's an authoritarian regime that's taken over, and it's a little bit like The Running Man, where there's a contest that can be held. It's King wrote this when he was young and angry. He was 19 when he wrote it, in the height of the Vietnam draft, going on, and he just viewed the U.S. military industrial complex as chewing up and spitting out its youth. And so he came up with this story about, this military-run state that uses the death of children, essentially these teenagers, yeah. For entertainment. It's written by an angry young man, but what's really interesting about the Francis Lawrence movie is that it is, to me, way more optimistic about humanity than even I got from reading the book. And pretty much everything that was in the book is in there with the support structure that happens. But this isn't... Let me just put it this way. I think that if they actually made The Long Walk now, and it was real on TV, it would be nothing but backstabbing, people fucking each other over, yeah. Everybody trying to get everybody killed so they could get the ultimate prize. The ultimate prize, all these kids walk until there's only one left, and that one gets whatever wish they want, all the riches, all that stuff, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of all those Food Network shows of people just like struggling to to make the best dish, and they're all just like, they all hate each other, and
It might be, yeah. What's funny is like this is the Great British Bake Off, right? Yeah, this is everybody is supportive of each other. Like if they finish early, they're helping other people. Yeah. During lockdown, I was like, maybe some of my humanity is restored watching Great British Bake Off, because it's the opposite of American. Because
you feel warm and fuzzy, and you go, "This is nice," and they're making cakes, and nothing could go wrong. And then you watch this, and you go, "We're fucked. Yeah. We're so fucked."
Right. You watch everything else, but like even like American reality TV, it's all about who can fuck over who the quickest.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. And I imagine if they did The Long Walk today, it would be a bloodbath. It'd be over in 5 hours. Everybody would be Barkovich.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, if you compare it to reality TV, it's kind of interesting because it has the same structure of there's a villain and then there's someone who's very sweet. And right. It's almost as though they wrote from the same playbook of this is how we make this in a way that's appealing to people.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have these judges who are overseeing everything, in the cars, following them everywhere. And, it's like, it does feel like it has, there's this spectatorship to it, which is probably why the studio thought of Francis Lawrence Ford having done the Hunger Games movies.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, and that goes back to my point where I was a little nervous he wasn't going to go as extreme with it, because if you don't, it doesn't have to be a bloodbath. And as you said, like he shows a lot of restraint for a lot of the kills, but you need to know that this is a Vietnam War allegory. It can't be dressed up and pretty. You have to see, and the characters have to realize the situation they're in. Cause it goes from being this, just ultimate thought and the folly of youth, I'm never going to die, I'm always going to be the winner, to seeing, oh, well, what if I get a cramp? What if something beyond my control? What if I catch a cold during this? It's like any
random thing. What if I have to
shit?
Yeah.
Which is a big thing in the movie.
Yeah, those are things that happen in capitalism all the time. Yeah,
exactly. And when those guys had to shit, I was like, yeah, I've been there. I've been in public places where I had to go and I couldn't. And what would happen?
have you experienced
like right now,
this? Okay. Exactly what happens in The Long Walk?
Yeah, if you wait to the end of the show, Chris is going to take a shit right on the stage just for your entertainment. Yeah.
Yes, please whip out your phones. And tweet
we need something for the 40th anniversary of Fantastic Fest sizzle reel, so make sure you record that. I'm not sure. I actually haven't been paying attention. I don't know if it like did a huge box office, but it is the kind of movie where I feel like you're right. There's awards worthy stuff in this movie. Yeah. There's a lot of really interesting directorial choices too. Like you never once cut away from the group. To see like somebody watching The Long Walk, you see a camera early on, and that's it. You are only with those guys, and that to me, like I can't imagine the studio notes were like, well, we need to cut away and see who's watching it on TV and who, and whatever. You don't see any of that. Matter of fact, the only escape you get is into an even worse reality when you have Cooper Hoffman, he kind of sleeping on his feet.
Yeah. And that too, it kind of relies on a lot of oneers of just these characters talking. And so all of the cast just has to be so good because they're letting them interact with each other.
Right.
And I just imagine the way to block that too. It's just anything else. Because I thought about that. I'm like, okay, you need to have conversations with characters where other people aren't involved, and then they come back, and so just kind of morphing the group onto themselves.
And the actors are speed walking the whole movie, and it's these long, like you said, these long takes of them genuinely speed walking. And and it's funny because, like, they said they shot the movie, I think they said chronologically.
They did, yeah.
And while I was watching the movie, I was like, I think some of these actors have genuinely actually gotten better shape by the end of this movie. Right. You can see it, that it's, like, actually affecting
them. Method, by choice or not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we had Ben Wang on the show who played Olsen, nice. Right? And he has, you know, his character is extremely sad because he's one of the first of the core group to fall. But, like, he's gone by the end of it. Like, in the way he plays it, I think he said it was that somebody, like, nobody kept actual count of how long they walked, but they said that they had their phones in their backpacks or whatever. So, like, they had some sort of recording, and they figured it out that it was probably around 400 miles that they all walked before the end of the...
Oh my God.
The shoot, and for the people who made it to the end, of course. Yeah. So, no, I think he said he hit 400 miles, and he wasn't one of the last few to go. So,
yeah. No, it's intense. And I think another thing I really love about it too is just how it examines masculinity in a really amazing way. Are we allowed to say plot spoilers?
Sure.
If I say plot spoiler, anyone who hasn't heard it, please like cover your ears for this.
Earmuffs. Yeah.
But one of the last things that is said at, like, the very end of the movie, he says, "I loved you," to the other guy before he dies. And to me, that was one of the most powerful moments in the entire movie.
Right.
And I love seeing that with these characters.
Right. Which, you know, it's a parallel people, you know, kind of talking about it in different feels, but it's very similar to Stand By Me, where it's an examination of, you know, male bonding in a way that isn't... you know, I don't know, alpha bullshit, but it's also, you know, not true. You know, there is some posturing, there is some, you know, they're having fun, they're cracking jokes, they have the gallows humor, which is definitely something that a lot of the boys like to do, you know, and laugh about that. But, you know, that's what I was talking about how it's surprisingly an optimistic view of humanity that core group would help each other, that they would be there, that they, like, not think about their own winning, you know, of this, because, you know, the penalty for not winning is death, right? And the fact that these guys bond together early and they go out of their way to save each other to the point, you know, where, you know, they're putting themselves in danger, it is, again, it's very optimistic about humanity in a way that makes me hopeful. But
it makes me question if it's optimistic, though, because the entire movie they're helping each other and that's beautiful, but then in the end they die anyways and we see them come out of it. But that's why I think it's kind of an amazing ending to look at, is it optimistic or is it not, because we could go, okay, everything we can do to try to stop this system is come together like this, but we still need to change the system as a whole, and we're not there yet at the end of the movie.
Right.
And there's also an opportunity, you know, that they have with this idea of you get your one wish fulfilled, you know, and the opportunity where if you genuinely had that, would you use it for the good of everyone, or would you ask for whatever you wanted? And I think that factors into it too, with this person who finally, they're so sure that he will choose a selfish thing. They're so sure. It's like, it's a selfish wish for sure. And when he chooses something that is for the good of everyone or the betterment of our future, I think that's also asking us a question too. I mean, how many times have we been given an opportunity to make a choice that actually will affect others positively but might not necessarily give us what we want right now?
Yeah.
And the fact that the movie explores that, I thought was really beautiful.
Yeah. Well, everyone, it's easier to be giving when you don't have a lot. And then when someone gets in a situation, all of a sudden they have a lot of money or they won something big, people sometimes switch. And so it's what will you actually do when you get to that point?
Right.
Yeah. Well, Chris, do we want to move on to your chosen topic? This might surprise people.
No. So I have a very chaotic brain and I apologize. It's very difficult for me to pick one thing. And if I had to, I would say The Shining. It's objectively like my favorite Stephen King movie because it's fucking perfect. But also
he would disagree with you on that, but he's wrong about it. I'm more than happy.
Everyone has talked about The Shining. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I could be like, yeah, The Shining's really good. And then people are like, uh-huh, okay, cool, skip.
Right.
Glad you talked about that movie again. So I would like to talk about Dr. Sleep, because
Shining adjacent. We got it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Dr. Sleep is, I think, maybe the riskiest studio movie for a filmmaker to ever take on, because you have got to appease two gigantic fan bases. Stephen King, who wrote The Shining.
Right.
And Stanley Kubrick, who directed The Shining, mm-hmm. because Kubrick's Shining is not necessarily King's Shining, and you know that's a long history of people understanding that they didn't quite mesh.
Right.
But also there's a Dr. Sleep book, and you have to adapt that properly. And there's things that are in that book that don't coincide with Kubrick's film, and things that are in Kubrick's film, like the Overlook Hotel, are synonymous with The Shining for 99% of the population. Right. And so you have to make some changes to it. And Mike told me that like every day he would wake up while shooting that movie, and on one side of his bed he would have the Dr. Sleep book, and he had a TV in that room, and he would play scenes from The Shining every single morning to just kind of be in both worlds at the same time and somehow try to make everyone happy. And the fact that that movie is as good as it is, it's, I think it's great, is a fucking miracle.
It is. It's a miracle movie for exactly the reasons you just said. It's something that extends an olive branch to both and tries to marry both. And I think that Mike Flanagan, the director who produced Shelby Oaks, I think he said on the show that King, at the beginning of all this, was just like very hesitant about this, especially when his pitch was, you can't make a sequel to The Shining on film and not acknowledge the Kubrick movie.
Yeah.
But in, you know, after seeing it, I think it helped King make peace with the movie in a weird way.
Yeah, I feel like it was actually, like you said, an olive branch for him. I also love how there's flashbacks in Dr. Sleep, and they hired actors, like, you know, to play those younger versions of the characters. It's not just like de-aging CGI bullshit.
The deep fake Jack Nicholson at the bar at the end, or Henry Thomas.
Exactly. Like, you know, get Henry Thomas in there. E.T., good old Elliot needs some Jack Torrance, some Jack Torrance work. You know, that really inspired me when I saw that film, because I knew Mike a little bit at that time just as a friend, but seeing that in a theater with the like original Warner Brothers logo coming up and getting those vibes immediately and the music and everything. He was really smart in how he appeased the fans in that way, made everyone feel warm and safe. Like, I know this world. This is The Shining. I feel this way. But then as soon as you're with Ewan McGregor's character and seeing what he's like as an adult, and obviously Mike's history that he's been very open with about his own battles with sobriety, and being able to tell that in that way through a genre lens, it just felt personal to me. I say it's a miracle because it feels like a Mike Flanagan movie. It feels personal, like he put his own blood and DNA in it. But it also feels like a sequel to Kubrick's vision. And it feels like a King satisfying adaptation. And I could never wrap my brain around how many different wires he was crossing to make that work, but he did it.
I mean, it's funny because usually when you hear someone say, make something to make everyone happy, that's when you think, bad movie.
Right, exactly. 100%.
It's almost a recipe for bad movies. Yes. So the fact that that's able to exist is incredible in and of itself.
And let's get it, I mean, let's put it on the table. Dr. Sleep, the book, is fucking weird.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he makes this sequel to The Shining, and you're like, great, you know, let's get into another hotel, or what's Danny Torrance up to these days? And then it starts you off as like, yeah, Danny Torrance is really fucked up and is making all the same mistakes his father did, in worse ways almost. And also there's a roving band of nomadic, soul-sucking vampires that are out there that are some thousands of years old, and they're, you know, sucking the shine out of children.
Yeah.
Like, go, make that movie, Mike Flanagan. And he had to drastically change a lot from the book, which again is something that King hated that Kubrick did, but it works so well within the context of adapting Dr. Sleep. Because like you said, you can't make a sequel that people know The Shining and then they're like, what do you mean the Overlook burnt down? Like, what do you mean, you know, Jack Torrance kind of was a good guy at the end?
It's room 237, right? Like, that's the number,
Yes, 237, not 217. What the hell are you doing? So, you know, Dr. Sleep, I remember being very surprised, like you, when I saw it. And you know, and I didn't know Mike at this time, but I was familiar with like Gerald's Game. He did Gerald's Game, which was another kind of unadaptable thing, and he recently this year did The Life of Chuck, you know, which is another one. When you read it, you're like, nobody in the right mind would make it. And I don't know, Flanagan's got a history of making the unadaptable King stuff.
I thought Life of Chuck was so fantastic. It's a movie that I wished more people had seen so I could talk about it to everybody.
Well, if I have my way, I would love it for the next Oscars to be Stephen King overloaded, man. Can you imagine if Life of Chuck gets an Oscar push?
It should. It got the People's Choice of Toronto.
Yeah, you know, and The Long Walk gets its Oscar push. Yeah. It's like, you know, maybe Mark Hamill can get dual Best Supporting Actors for his two Stephen King appearances this year.
Can I tell a Mark Hamill story real quick?
Please.
I've never met him. I would love to. I hope I can. But I was very fortunate enough to be shown Life of Chuck at Mike's house. He brought me to his house, and he has this amazing collection of Stephen King memorabilia. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
I have, yeah.
It's fucking crazy.
He has the radio from 1408.
Yes.
You know, the one that keeps
And his little, his wonderful little son was like, watch this, and ran up and turned it on and watched it count down. He was looking at me, smiling.
What
I
a childhood.
I saw, like, his children are getting into it, too. He's got the fucking typewriter from Misery. Uh-huh. He's got, literally has the letter from the end of Shawshank Redemption that Morgan Freeman finds underneath a tree. Uh-huh. And it's just insane. So I sit down in his screening room, and he shows me Life of Chuck, and I'm crying, and I'm like, this is amazing. And he's like, you know, Mark Hamill was just sitting there, where you're sitting. And I was like, Luke Skywalker was just sitting here? It was just so crazy. It was really the most surreal experience to be there and watch it. And that movie is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one that I can't be objective about. It's one that I started the KingCast with the late, great Scott Wampler, and we both had, we both had little appearances in the movie, and, you know, originally it was like, oh, maybe we'll get to go out and visit the set, and then one day Mike emails us and goes, hey, there's this part at the beginning where there's these two NPR hosts are talking about the end of the world, and I was thinking maybe you and Scott could do this, and I'm just like, well, you know, we're not actors, right? We're going to fuck up your movie if you do this. He's like, no, don't worry about it. You got it. Just record it like you'd normally do. So we recorded it like we record the podcast. But when Mike sent over the script, he's like, okay, it's here. You'll see it. You know, it's NPR number one and NPR number two or whatever. It's like, okay, great. And I get to it, and it's a page and a half of fucking dialogue. And I'm like, again, we're not actors. Like, you're inviting some really terrible line readings here. But we did it, and we thought that was kind of it. And then, you know, when we went to set, you know, I don't know if you guys knew how many people saw Life of Chuck here, but one of the conceits of the movie is that you see the world falling apart in our first act, the third act of the story, and then the middle act, you start seeing Chuck, played by Tom Hiddleston, and all the things that, and people and faces and voices that are around him, are in the back of his mind that influence what you had just seen, right? And you get more of that, you know, as the movie goes on. And so I guess Mike, in a weird way, was like, it would make sense for him to have overheard you two. So he threw us in a background scene behind Hiddleston. And I had the same experience with you when I saw The Life of Chuck, where I went to Mike's house. I was out in LA for my birthday. He was like, hey, you know, you can watch. I have a cut of the movie. And I tried to get Wampler to go out with me. And I'm like, you should come out. We're going to be meeting up with a bunch of, you know, KingCast regulars and, you know, hanging out with people. And Mike wants to show The Life of Chuck. And he's like, nah, man, I'm not into it. And they're like, I'll just see it when it comes out. And unfortunately, he passed before that happened. And, you know, it's so there's a lot of weird emotions that are, you know, that I'm tied up in with that. It's a yearbook. It's a moment in time. I know Scott was very proud of what he did, but he never got to see it. And, you know, now I just kind of think about it, and they're the what ifs, right? And weirdly, the theme of the movie is to enjoy the moment and make sure you take advantage
That's so
of the
true.
Moments.
Yeah.
And it's like, I wish I would have pushed harder for him to go out, but nobody hated travel more than Scott Wampler did. Like, to get him to get on an airplane, you either had to hold a gun to his head or, you know, give him a carrot he couldn't resist. And, but,
There's
so
a
it's hard
for him in the credits.
There
right?
is. Yeah.
Yeah,
the
that's
mic.
Really sweet.
Mike was actually in Austin the day that Scott passed, and he was at the ATX festival, and he was one of the first people to reach out to me. And that day, you know, was a blur. Sorry, we're bumming everybody out. I'm so sorry. But he was like, you know, hey man, like, dude, let's just go out, you know, get away from the phone, get away from all that stuff. And we went out to eat and talked about it. And he told me then that it's like, I'm asking the producers if we can dedicate the movie to him. And, so, you know, he gets a little bit of immortality there, you know, I think. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, And the wonderful folks at the Alamo dedicated a theater, Theater 5, I believe. Is it 5? It's 5, yeah, I think. is the Scott Wampler Memorial Theater. So he's getting to live on in many ways. But I like to think that in 30, 40, 50 years when people are watching The Life of Chuck, because I think it's a movie that'll survive.
I think it's
people
a 10
will
out
go,
of 10.
I wonder who that guy was, you know?
Yeah.
Especially with that movie. So yeah. Sorry, didn't mean to bum anybody out, but we can move on to talking about how hot Rebecca Ferguson is, if you want to. That's something Scott would have appreciated. So
yeah. She's amazing as Rose the Hat. Insane, absolutely incredible. But also the child performances in Dr. Sleep are amazing too.
Yeah.
He always gets great child performances in his films. Could I like take a minute to talk about a Stephen King movie that I don't like the term guilty pleasure because
right.
I just think that my guilty pleasures are just pleasures.
Right.
I just like stuff.
Hell yeah.
You know, I don't have to be like, I know this is bad, but it's good. I just like it.
If you like it, you like it.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
And I love Secret Window. I love that movie. I fucking love that movie, man. I've watched it so many times. I saw it with my mom when I was like 16 and it's a good. I think this is part of it. It's a core memory for me and her that we used to go to the movies a lot, and we were always trying to find like a scary movie or something that she loved horror and you know. And Secret Window just felt so like warm and inviting. It was a cabin in the woods by a lake and an obsessed writer, which of course King has done a lot of authors and his books. But like, and Depp is great in the movie. He was fresh off for Pirates of the Caribbean, and so he was kind of like this insane, like the hottest actor alive at the time, literally, and also at the budget, at the box office. And I've just always loved that movie for its weirdness. It's such a strange movie, and it has like my favorite monologue at the end with the corn.
With the corn, know? Yeah, and his weird braces, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you?
By the
do
way,
you wanna,
after I got braces, by the way, I was like, he would never eat corn on the cob with braces.
That's it's impossible. Disgusting.
Yeah, they'd all just pop out.
Yeah. Can you tell people what the story is here? Because that's one that I don't think is super well known.
Well, it's because I think I understand that it's not anyone's favorite or anything. I think I just have a major soft spot for it. Basically, Secret Window is about an author who another author comes to his door, played by John Turturro, and is like, "You stole my story," and accuses him of plagiarism right to his face. And he's like, "I have no idea who you are. I've never heard of you in my life." And his name is John Shooter. And he puts his manuscript on his porch and a rock on top of it and forces him out of curiosity to read this manuscript. And he realizes while reading it that he has written something eerily similar to this manuscript. Mm. And he has no memory of plagiarizing it.
Right.
But it's like crazily similar. My favorite part about it is that John Shooter is such a better writer than him. And when you're reading his version of it and he's like, fuck. And it's like the same story, but written so much better.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, it's making him even more stressed out that it's like, maybe I stole his shit and his shit is better than me.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it goes in some places that are familiar, but I just think that the weirdness of it, and they don't make $40 million, you know, horror movies anymore like that. It's from a bygone era where like real money was given to a movie about one guy in a cabin going crazy. And I miss that too.
What an era.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the peak weird parts, what do you feel is the trailer moment if you're like, oh, this is the weirdest, as weird
for
as it gets?
Secret Window?
Yeah.
Well, for spoilers, I apologize, but it has one of my favorite endings, which is like the whole movie is his wife is estranged from him. They're finalizing their divorce. He's doesn't really want to sign the papers. It's a lot of arguing. You find out she cheated on him with another man, and it's sent him down a spiral. And there's all this arguing for the whole movie. And there's this monologue in the book that he supposedly plagiarized. It's something like, "I know I can do it," Todd Downey said, "as I took another ear of corn from the steaming bowl. Soon, all of her will be gone," something like that. And then her death will be a mystery even to me. And it's my favorite, this line of like, I will kill someone and then literally not care so much that I will forget that I even did it. And the ending of the movie is you see him, you don't know where the bodies of his ex-wife and cheating lover are buried. and the camera descends out of a window down towards a row of corn that's growing out of the ground, and then starts to go underneath the ground, and the very next shot is him just biting into an ear of corn.
Fantastic.
And you're like, this motherfucker is literally eating corn that's growing on top of his ex-wife's body.
Yeah.
And I think that is the greatest like revenge I've ever seen in a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, yeah, there's a whole weird twist where, you know, again, we're spoiling everything.
Yeah,
but
sorry.
The person accusing him of the story is imaginary, and everybody that's dying and everybody that's getting hurt and all the vandalism that's happening, it's all him,
yeah.
And, you know, doing it to himself. But and you know, so he's imagining John Turturro in a big weird hat on his front door.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because that's almost, you know, the Fight Club plot twist. I'm sent so many scripts where people, it's kind of the film school first short thing where you go, and it was all in their head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when it was in that era, it's the best plot twist ever. But now that it's been done, you can't
for
do
sure.
it like that anymore.
When it works, it works.
Yeah.
And for me, it worked in that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that movie. I always have.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it is an interesting era. And, you know, this is before Johnny Depp, like, kind of checked out. Right, so he is in that period of time where he's like just still bringing it all into this weird fucking movie that, like you said, can't be made, you know, now. But that era, you know, not that it was, you know, all rose petals and happiness in the studio system at that point. You know, we're seeing the death of the indie movement, you know, in that era too. But you get movies like that, and you got like 1408, which is another underappreciated Stephen King adaptation.
I quote that movie all the time. There's this line where John Cusack is starting to be convinced that the room is real,
uh-huh.
and the clock is counting down, and he goes, "Very effective." And I think of that all the time. Very effective, like when you experience something that has like a real impact on you.
Right. I say, it's an evil fucking room.
That's great
time,
too.
So, yeah.
I love that one too.
Is there a Stephen King movie that you love that maybe isn't like mostly appreciated? I mean, it could be. You might love all of them equally, but is there something? Like,
I mean, we already talked about. I would say Life of Chuck, not because it's not really well rated and well loved, but just because for how good it is, I want more people to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a TV miniseries. This isn't like, I wouldn't say this is underrated. Like, people love this, but fucking Storm of the Century.
It's so good.
Fucking love Storm
so
of the
good.
Century. Scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. Andre Lenoge, Born in Sin, Come on In. Like, that's the greatest fucking line. I could talk about this forever, man.
Yeah.
Sorry. I know your podcast is like, talk about this thing.
Nah,
but
man.
But it's very like, I love it all.
Yeah, you know? No, we love going down the blind alleyways at the show. But I will say that Storm of the Century was kind of a sleeper for me because I remember when it came out and I remember going, yeah, that's fine. You know, I liked it or whatever. And I didn't revisit it until we started the show again. And Meredith Borders from Fangoria, she came on and she's like, I want to talk about Storm of the Century. It's like, okay, I'll dig it up and watch this, you know, late 90s, early aughts, miniseries. Like, it's like a main network, right? It's like ABC miniseries or something. It's like, all right, I'll watch this. And I watch it, and I'm like, this is so fucking good. It's a story about parents that have to make an impossible choice, which I love. If you guys haven't seen it or don't remember, you know, a guy comes in and essentially goes, hey, here's this little tall island, which is where Dolores Claiborne, I believe, is set. You know, a big storm comes in, knocks out every power source, and they're all kind of trapped together. And this one mysterious guy, very Satan-coded, and comes in and says, hey, I want one of your children. You have to choose, or I'm killing everybody. So, you know, I'll kill all your children, or I will take one. You guys choose. And so then, like, the back half of the story is the parents going, well, maybe there's a lottery. Maybe, you know, one. I mean, just the good of the many outweighs the needs of the few, right? So it's like
similar
it's like,
to
we'll
killing of a sacred deer.
Kind yeah,
of. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, and it is super effective. That's one that people don't talk about as much. I would say 1408 is another great example of stuff that people don't talk about. Night Flyer is another weird fucking Stephen King.
Never
really?
Seen, no, never seen it.
Okay, Night Flyer was an HBO movie starring Miguel Ferrer as a tabloid reporter that is on the investigation of, there's like a little Cessna, like a little do-it-yourself pilot, you know, Harrison Ford piloted plane, right? That's going from all these like tiny airports to tiny airports, and every time it stops, people end up dead. turns out there's a vampire flying the Cessna, and this sleazy, and Miguel Ferrer plays a scumbag, piece of shit, and he is chasing this down, and the closer he gets to it, the more, like, you know, the more he gets in, he interacts with the vampire, and the more weird and mystical it gets. In the very end, I won't spoil the ending, but there's a directorial choice that's really interesting, where it turns into almost a Mario Bava film, where he enters an airport where a massacre had happened, and it goes to, like, black and white, and it's filled with fog. It's surreal. It is, like, the most bonkers, you know, King thing that nobody fucking knows, because it was like an HBO movie and they don't have it available anywhere. Right. So I tried to get it. Stephen Graham Jones, the author, came into town recently. He really wanted to screen it, but the rights are so fucked up that we couldn't actually, you know, get the rights to do it. We did Silver Bullet instead, so it wasn't.
Oh, nice. Cool.
That sounds like something that would be cool at Fantastic Fest.
It would. We got to work for Fantastic Fest 21 Night Flyer. Let's do it. Well, is there anything? Do you guys want to kind of talk a little bit or pitch about? You both have movies that are on the horizon. You guys want to do your pitch?
Everyone should go see Bone Lake in theaters October 3rd.
Nice.
It was at Fantastic Fest last year, and it was so awesome because the reception we got, it was our people loving our type of movie, and it led to it getting picked up by Bleecker Street.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm such a big fan to talk to these people here about it, too.
I literally Power Fantastic cannot Fest. Wait to see Bone Lake. It looks so fucking good.
Thank you. Yeah. I know. I can't wait. Yours sold out. I didn't even have a chance. I'm excited.
Yeah, last night was crazy. We showed Shelby Oaks last night. It comes out October 24th. See both of our movies. Support.
Yes.
October is for horror. We got Bone Lake. We got Good Boy. We got Black Phone 2. We got my movie. Let's make tell Hollywood that October is for horror and keep it that way.
Yes.
Yeah. Stop releasing horror movies in fucking August, please. I mean, release them every month, but don't. Yeah, give us something for the Halloween feels. We love the Halloween feels. So. Thank you guys so much for coming up on stage and bullshitting some Stephen King with me. I appreciate it, and thank you all for listening.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.